Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Contact tracing is a key strategy touted by Pennsylvania health officials as an integral part of stopping or mitigating the spread of the coronavirus. Contact tracing involves identifying or at least determining who may have come into contact with an infected person. Those who have been in contact with an infected person should be tested for the virus or quarantined for 14 days. The challenge is in the resources it requires to track accurately. Many counties in Pennsylvania have moved forward with reopening plans, even without the resources and trained personnel in place to conduct the tracing, and as a result, contact tracing appears to be inconsistent throughout the state. Joining us today's program is Spotlight PA reporter Aneri Patani, who has written about this issue. Aneri Patani, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And Aneri, for context, how does contact tracing work?
Yeah, so the idea is relatively simple, and it's actually, you know, a public health technique that has been used for years. It's not new to COVID-19. They use it for measles. They use it for sexually transmitted infections, HIV, everything. The idea is essentially when someone tests positive, in this case for COVID-19, a health official will ask them, who have you come in contact with recently, and then gather those names and numbers, call those individuals and let them know, you know, not the name of the individual who tested positive, but just you have come in contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. You should either get tested yourself or you should quarantine for 14 days as you may be infected and you may unknowingly spread that virus to others.
Explain why contact tracing is the key to slowing down the spread of the coronavirus and possibly avoiding a second wave of infections.
So right now, we don't have any clear treatment for the coronavirus, and vaccine development is still in the works. It could take months. A lot of experts are saying more likely it could take years to get a vaccine. So in the meantime, this is really the best way, public health experts say, to prevent the spread, to prevent future outbreaks. Because when you realize that one individual has tested positive, the way you stop that from growing to more and more people is first figuring out, ideally, experts say, within 24 hours, everyone they've come in contact with, calling those contacts and letting them know. So that way, those individuals can choose to stay at home to decrease their contact with the outside world, and so they don't spread it to another round of people. And the reason you need to make those calls within 24 hours, public health experts say, is otherwise, you know, if, let's say, Scott, I've tested positive and you've come in contact with me, but you don't know that I've tested positive, you're going to go to the grocery store, you're going to go to the pharmacy. As we're reopening, you're going to go to work, you might go to the gym. And suddenly now, if you're a carrier of the virus without symptoms, you may have spread it to all those people. If a public health official calls you within 24 hours and says, hey, you've been in contact with someone who tested positive, you may stop going to those places and instead stay at home, and that would decrease the number of cases potentially many times over.
So time is very important, but so are numbers. We're going to talk about some of the timing of this in a few minutes, but is Pennsylvania currently doing enough contact tracing?
So from most of the public health experts I've spoken with, no. I mean, you know, the Pennsylvania Department of Health has told me contact tracing is occurring in all regions and they are working to ramp up their abilities. But right now they are estimating that the state has about 500 individuals doing this work. That includes 130 state-employed public health nurses, a few hundred individuals employed by various counties, and then a slew of volunteers. However, when you talk to public health experts, the estimate of the number of tracers that Pennsylvania needs is between 2,000 and 4,000. So even at the low end of that estimate, 2,000 is way above where we're currently at with about 500.
Why isn't there any centralized plan from the state? I mean, you used the word in your report of caught in a patchwork of what we had in what you just described on a kind of a county by county basis. And the state does have some things going on. But why isn't it centralized through the Department of Health?
I mean, I can't answer for the Department of Health in terms of why it's not that way. What it seems is, you know, early on, contact tracing, and like I mentioned, contact tracing is done for all types of diseases. So the state's infrastructure for this type of work is 130 public health nurses across the state in different regions. Some of my previous reporting that, you know, you and I have discussed in the past,
yes,
looked at how there are not enough public health nurses to handle this onslaught of cases. And so when COVID-19 hit Pennsylvania, they were quickly overwhelmed. And so then, you know, the state had, counties had to turn to their own resources, and the patchwork really is, you know, some counties are contracting with nonprofits to do this work. Others are looking to hospital systems. In some places, the state is trying to train college students. Other public health schools themselves are volunteering their students and trying to train them. And it just, it, you know, it seems there's a sudden need. The state didn't have the public health infrastructure, the workforce, the investments in public health to begin with to be ready to respond when this happened. And so it's sort of been a scramble to get that system in place is what it seems like. And at this point, you know, the state is trying to put together what they're calling six regional consortiums, or essentially partnerships to bring together all these different efforts. But so far, only one has been announced, and that's in southwestern Pennsylvania. And from, you know, speaking with some of the individuals involved with that, it sounds like it's in the pretty early stages of coordinating these efforts between, like I said, different hospitals, nonprofits, colleges. Sort of every county, every region has a lot of disparate systems working on this.
We'll talk about some of the things that have been suggested, proposed, maybe in the works right now. But, Aneri, what you just described, everything seems to be moving very slowly. I mean, we're 3 months into this now. I can't ask why, but it is taking a long time to get all this together for something that I think everyone agrees is important to containing the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, you know, when I talked to the state, they said it was at the end of April that they put together a workforce to focus on contact tracing, to sort of build a system that would supplement the work of the public health nurses. And when you talk to public health experts across the nation, this is not a uniquely Pennsylvania problem. A lot of states have neglected public health over the years and have not invested. And so they, you know, are really working with bare bones staff to begin with, and they don't know where to turn and how to build up. You know, they're doing all this learning in the moment as they also need it to take place and be happening already, which is why, you know, right now public health experts are saying you need to have thousands of contact tracers, and the state is still saying, you know, by fall we aspirationally, you know, hope to have 1,000 in place. And there's a real mismatch in terms of the timeline and in terms of the numbers that people say are needed.
Yeah, just to backtrack and clarify, you said that the Department of Health is hoping to have 1,000 in place by the fall, but yet the people that you talk to, the experts, say that Pennsylvania needs many more than that, four times more than that, correct?
Yes, and the other key point is they say that we need them as you're reopening, because what happens during the reopening process is, you know, during the stay-at-home orders, generally one individual is not coming into contact with that many people. You know, potentially you have one trip to the grocery store or you know, for necessities. But as more and more counties move to yellow, and quite frankly, by Friday, most of Pennsylvania will be in the green phase of reopening, which means people are starting to go back to work. They're going to you know, get haircuts, they're going to restaurants, they're, you know, out and about more, which means they are coming in contact with more individuals. So if any one person tests positive, they're going to require a lot more calls. And to do those calls, you need to have people in place who are ready to do so. I mean, Erie County, for example, is already seeing this. Spoke to the public health director there, and she said, you know, when we're in the red phase, we would rarely see someone with 10 contacts. But even as they went to yellow phase of reopening, which is slightly less restricted, they started seeing people coming into contact with 10 people, 20 people, sometimes even as high as 30. So now you're talking about three times as many calls those contact tracers have to make.
So right now, as 66 of the 67 counties go to green, is just an essential time for contact tracing to be occurring around the state.
Exactly. This is the way you want to have this in place now so that you're preventing, you're allowing people to go about their lives without having future outbreaks that, you know, could potentially set us to another wave of shutdown orders.
The Department of Health put out a release on Friday, and I just want to read it here, and was talking about contact tracing, said that the state has now identified 4,000 COVID cases through contact tracing. And this is Secretary of Health, Dr. Rachel Levine. She says, we are now equipped with hundreds of contact tracers that can help us mitigate the spread of the virus, but we still need Pennsylvanians to be alert as COVID-19 remains a threat in the communities. We are proud to partner with dedicated individuals and organizations across the state to protect our neighbors who have come into contact with someone who has COVID-19. We encourage everyone to remain alert as we all continue to fight this ongoing virus. Now, when I first saw the number identified through contact tracing as 4,000, I thought to myself, well, I have no context here. I have no idea whether that's a lot or not a lot. But what the secretary is saying there is basically it's a pep talk to Pennsylvanians to be alert, that there's not a whole lot of substance there as far as providing information on more contact tracing. I mean, am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, that was my reading as well. I mean, with that 4,000 number, it's really hard to say. What she's saying is 4,000 contacts, which means calls to people who have come in contact with the individual who's tested positive. But that's really, you know, we don't know what the denominator is really of all the people who are testing positive in Pennsylvania. How many contacts do they all have in total? And so without knowing that total number, you know, the fact that they've reached 4,000, it's unclear if that's really enough or if that's slow. And really from, you know, talking to public health experts, a lot of it is not just can you reach the individual, it's how quickly can you reach them, right? Because if it takes you a week to reach someone who's come in contact with an infected individual, it's still, you know, good to let them know and ask them to quarantine. But at that point, they've, you know, for a week been out and about potentially spreading the virus to others. So it's something that not just needs to reach a certain number of people, it needs to reach a certain number of people within a short time frame.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Spotlight PA reporter Aneri Patani, who has written about contact tracing in Pennsylvania. And right now, in Aneri's story, it's described as a patchwork, and it's something that's very important to stopping the spread of the coronavirus and possibly halting a second wave. You know, Aneri mentioned this fall, that's when a lot of people are looking at a possible second wave when the weather gets colder and there's flu season, and, you know, there's a couple of things that are not related, but there could be a lot going on. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk, WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And Aneri, I want to go back a month or so, last month. Actually, Governor Wolf announced in May a plan to train people to be contact tracers, modeled after some programs that we've seen historically in the past. What happened to that?
Announced the Coronavirus Civilian Corps, the idea that they would take individuals who have been unemployed due to the pandemic and train them to serve in public health roles like contact tracing. And I actually, you know, heard from several individuals of the public who wanted to join that force and were, you know, very interested in helping Pennsylvania with this public health needs at the same time earning a paycheck. But it seems that no hiring has begun for that. In fact, I confirmed that with the state. They have not started hiring for those positions yet. Right now, they're relying solely on volunteers. What I was told is that the Coronavirus Civilian Corps, this idea is mainly for planning for a resurgence in the fall. And the state has grant money from the federal government, $7 million nearly, to hire individuals and train them in pandemic response. But there are, you know, a bunch of bureaucratic steps, essentially, is what they're telling me, different agencies that have to work together, approvals, final awards that have to happen. And so they are not hiring right now. And unfortunately, you know, what that means is some residents who reached out to me who had applied for this, who want to help, were really discouraged to learn that the state's only looking for volunteers right now. And it's not that, you know, I was told by several people they want to help and they understand the public health importance of this, but they're also, you know, trying to get their bills paid and keep food on the table. And so if they are going to devote a lot of time to something, it, you know, they have to make it a salaried position or a paying position. And so right now the state is not using those individuals who may want to help because it's not paying them.
Well, you know, it's unfortunate that bureaucracy is holding this up. But if, you know, it just would seem as though the money is there from the federal government and if volunteers can be trained, those who you know, want to be paid or should be paid, should be able to be trained as well. But what do you mean by, you described it a little bit, but what are some of the bureaucracy that's holding this up?
So essentially, I will not claim to be an expert on this, but what I was told by the State Department of Health is that this is an award that comes from the federal government. Pennsylvania has been notified that they will get it, but it's you know still being finalized. They're waiting for the final award to work on the next steps. The Department of Health at the state level has to work with labor and industry and sort of figure out a protocol for onboarding these individuals, vetting applications. Right now, they're asking most people to sign up as volunteers through a system called SERVPA, and even that is sort of takes time. The application is relatively lengthy, and the state, of course, has to background these individuals who are going to be working for the state and calling people. So to some extent, you know, there are necessary steps that have to take place, and to some extent, you know, it does seem that there are, you know, extra layers of bureaucracy that are maybe holding something up that could be really helpful for the state at the moment.
So what's happening across the state on a county level?
Really depends where you want to look. So a broad picture is, you know, some counties have their own health departments. There are six counties and four cities in Pennsylvania that have their own local health departments. In those places, they are really the ones in charge. You know, your largest ones are going to be Philadelphia and Allegheny, a lot of the Philadelphia suburbs, Erie County. Most of those places are using some combination of county employees and volunteers to do tracing work. Montgomery County has its own health department, but is decided to contract with various local nonprofits because they think the nonprofits will have better luck doing this work. They have more community trust. At times, you know, people can be concerned to have an individual calling them and asking who they've been in contact with, and the nonprofits also have an ability to let people or help connect people to food banks or pharmacy delivery services, other things that actually make quarantining possible, right? Because just because you tell someone you should stay at home now doesn't mean it's really possible for them. But then you look at other places, you know, Luzerne County I spoke with, and they've been hit pretty hard by the coronavirus, told me, you know, they don't have a health department to handle this. They are relying on the state, and they were essentially waiting for some time for communication from the state health department. And just a few weeks ago, we're told, you know, they're going to be using public health nurses to do this work, but we're not given a specific number. So I think it really depends, and certain counties are contracting with hospital systems. Lancaster County is contracted with Penn Medicine Lancaster General to do this work. Everywhere you look, it can be a little bit different. And what that means is, you know, counties that may not have hospitals and health systems or their own health departments to fall back on might be left with less robust systems, and they might just be relying on the state to see, you know, what those public health nurses can handle or if the state can, you know, deploy volunteers in their area. So some of them are still waiting to hear. In other areas, the counties are just taking it upon themselves.
Let's take a call from Norma, and I believe Norma's in Lancaster. Norma, you're on the air.
Actually, I'm in Gettysburg.
Oh, you're in Gettysburg. Okay.
I strongly support the value of contact tracing, but I wonder if some of the delay also relates to political opposition. And the reason I ask this question is that the Saturday Gettysburg Times quoted my state senator, Doug Mastriano, as saying contact tracing would be a very dangerous thing and a heavy-handed measure, and he's opposed to it, and nobody will be able to talk him into it. He believes it smacks of Stalinism and Orwellian control over people. This, to me, seems outrageous. Given the history of contact tracing as an effective public health measure, but I just wonder if your guest would respond to that. Is there political pressure trying to keep trying to prevent the expansion
Norma,
of this
thank you.
Valuable tool?
Norma, thank you very much for your call. Neri, did you run into that or hear anyone say that in the course of your reporting?
Yes, absolutely. I think, Norma, you're bringing up a really important point here. I think there are two ways I want to address that. When it comes to the politics, I mean, part of the discussion of why the state doesn't have this in place yet is, you know, there's been a lot of pressure to resume normal operations and to reopen quickly. And so there's some concern that potentially, you know, when Governor Wolf and Secretary Levine originally talked about reopening, having a robust contact tracing system in place was supposed to be a prerequisite. And then, you know, along with testing and other measures, it seems a lot of those were dialed back as there was more of a emphasis on reopening and moving forward. So right now, you know, for example, if you look at the dashboard that the state has to let you know when a county is, you know, quote unquote, ready to move to the green phase of reopening, it gives them a check mark under contact tracing. But what that means is not contact tracing is happening. It means it's either happening or it's simply, you know, in the process of being implemented. So they're sort of moved from this needs to be in place prior to reopening to it's okay if we're, you know, figuring it out as we reopen. And there's certainly an element of politics to that. And then the second part that, you know, Norma's bringing up is this concern about privacy and contact tracing being some sort of surveillance method. And I think what you said is really important, that this is not a new thing with COVID-19. This is a public health tool that has been used for years and years. And the thing that a lot of county officials, nonprofits, health systems, everyone who's doing this work emphasized to me is that it really is confidential. They're not calling someone and saying, you know, you came in contact with, you know, Jane Doe here who tested positive at this time and date and she exposed you and this is what happened. They're just saying, you know, you have come in contact with someone and here are some steps you can take and how can we help you stay safe so that this virus doesn't spread to others. It's not meant to, you know, share anyone's private health information with anyone else. But certainly that distrust is a barrier that some of the contact tracers are facing.
Well, success does count on people who are contacted to answer questions voluntarily. LNP in Lancaster reported this weekend that less than half the people the contact tracers left messages with actually returned their calls, and one in five said they wouldn't quarantine anyway. So I don't know whether you're aware of that report, Neri, but that would seem to, and quoted in the story were people from Lancaster General Health saying, you know, we need people to cooperate for this to be successful. So that's another part of this, is that we need the public to cooperate.
Absolutely. I mean, contact tracing is entirely voluntary, and it only works the more people who agree to do it. So I know, you know, like I said, lots of health officials have been making the plea to the public that, you know, this is really for the safety of the entire community to allow places to reopen and stay open. The less contact tracing they're able to do, the, you know, less likely it is that they can prevent future outbreaks and potentially, you know, we'll have to go back to stricter measures in terms of staying at home or having fewer businesses open. So I know a lot of counties have made that plea. And like I said, some counties, Berks and Montgomery County specifically that I spoke to, are trying to contract with local nonprofits to do this work because they're hoping that these are institutions that are trusted in the community. They've been providing social services for a while, and potentially, you know, that will help individuals connect with them. They're also trying to be mindful of you have to have tracers who speak different languages and can connect with people culturally. So they are trying to build up those workforces, but it's certainly, you know, a challenge. And I think we're going to be hearing more and more about that as we move forward, how much cooperation the tracers get.
When we're talking about politics, Inari, you know, over the weekend on Saturday at his rally in Tulsa, President Trump suggested that one of the reasons that more cases are being reported is that there's more testing being done. And, of course, right now a big controversy is him saying that he requested fewer tests to be conducted. But, and I don't know whether you can answer this question or not, but are there any figures to show where contact tracing is more robust that more cases are reported?
I actually do not know that. I think that that's a great question. I think there, you know, both contact tracing and testing play a role in that in terms of where the most cases are reported. Important measure with testing, though, that I think most, or not most, but a lot of people are starting to look at is not just the raw number of tests or positive tests, but the percentage of individuals who are testing positive, which is, you know, potentially shedding more light on an issue rather than just, you know, if we're testing more people, are a greater proportion of them testing positive or a lesser proportion? And sometimes that can be more indicative of changing trends.
We have an email from a listener, John, in Enola. And this kind of follows up on what I was talking about, the Lancaster report. John says, while I agree that contact tracing can provide benefits in reducing the spread of COVID-19, I have a major objection with a contact trace that tracer told me I needed to quarantine for 2 weeks just because I was in contact with someone who tested positive. A two-week quarantine would be detrimental to me personally, as I'm sure it would be to others. Contact tracers should simply be advising contacts to be tested. Just being in contact with an infected person doesn't mean a person will be infected. Inari, people you talk to, that goes along with the Lancaster report that, you know, we are in the grain phase now. The state, many people see that as the state is open, and there are so many people who have said, we are over this. We're done with it. Mm-hmm. And look at this as, you know, that they are going to be impacted detrimentally. So what do the experts say about that?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a few things, right? If I think the main issue here is, yes, ideally anyone who is contacted by a contact tracer could simply go and get tested and they would know right away if they were infectious or not, or sorry, if they were carrying the virus or not, and could make a decision on that basis. Unfortunately, right now, you know, the testing is not so easily available and widespread that every single individual who may come in contact with an infected individual can just get that test right away. And that's why we're at a place where, you know, quarantining is going to be the next best measure that contact tracers can suggest. That being said, I mean, it's a very fair point that staying at home for 14 days is not an easy thing. And it is going to affect people economically, socially, in all these different ways. So I think there has been a large push in a lot of the hospital systems I spoke to in particular. You know, they were talking about training their tracers, not just to say, you know, you need to stay at home, but can we give you a written statement that says to your employer, this is why the individual needs to stay at home, to help make that conversation or transition easier? Can we connect you to a food bank that can deliver food to your house for 14 days to make that easier, or a pharmacy delivery service? Or, you know, can we connect you with housing supports if it's an issue of paying rent or mortgage? So I think there have to be, you know, the secondary layer of services that can actually make quarantining possible. Because for a lot of people, it's really not feasible to say that, you know, just stay at home for 14 days and figure it out. The problem, again, though, is, you know, the more services you need to provide, the more resources you need, the more individuals, you know, if a phone call is going to take an hour or 2 hours as I'm connecting you to all these resources, we need more people to be doing those phone calls with everyone. Interesting suggestion that I heard in speaking with Representative Dan Frankel from Allegheny County is the idea of potentially providing a financial incentive for individuals to stay home. He said he's considering introducing a bill to that effect that would basically use some state or federal funding to provide individuals payment during the time they need to stay at home in quarantine. That has not, you know, made its way into anything real at this point, but that was an idea he floated based on something that's being done in Israel.
You said earlier that Pennsylvania is not alone in having this patchwork of contact tracers. What are other states doing?
There are a lot of different efforts at play. Massachusetts, which is noted a lot, has partnered with a nonprofit to hire nearly 1,700 tracers. They've already hired some individuals. Some counties in Maryland are using school health nurses who are, you know, not in session right now, using them to do the work. San Francisco is training librarians. A lot of states are turning to public health universities and to train college students. So I think we are seeing some of the same steps that Pennsylvania is taking. But other places, you know, New York is hiring a lot of people, and they are, you know, paying for those jobs. So is New Jersey to some extent. So there are a lot of different efforts at play, and some of them Pennsylvania is adopting and is trying to ramp up. And some of them, it seems Pennsylvania is not necessarily trying what other states are at the moment.
Well, we pretty much established that Pennsylvania is moving kind of slowly. Final question, Inari. Is there any reason to be optimistic, or are we just going to have to be patient? And if it does continue to move slowly, it would seem as though more people will be infected.
Oh, man.
I know. That's tough.
Yeah, you know, I certainly hope we're able to ramp it up. To be fair, you know, when we're talking about Pennsylvania residents, there are nearly or around 700 people registered through the volunteer system, Serve PA, the state told me. And that's a high number, and I've been contacted by individuals who want to help with that civilian coronavirus core and you know, take paid jobs to do this work. So I think there is an interest. What's really missing is the next steps of deploying those volunteers and organizing them, or, you know, getting the funding in place to start hiring these people who want to help. So I think it is possible, but how quickly we're able to ramp that up, and if it's you know, done fully and consistently in time to prevent future outbreaks rather than responding to them reactively, we'll just have to wait and see.
Spotlight PA reporter Inari Patani. Inari, good to have you on the program. Always great to talk to you. Reporting, been following it on a daily basis. Spotlight PA, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk, and I want to tell you about tomorrow's program. We've tried to do this every week since Pennsylvania, the spread of the coronavirus started here in Pennsylvania, and that is to have a doctor, medical professional on Smart Talk, I say every week, maybe every 10 days or so, to answer your questions. I mean, so far, 3 months into this, there still are a lot of questions about the virus itself, what we've learned in those 3 or 4 months since it's been here in the United States. And I have to say that I'm surprised how many people still have questions. I mean, I have, but still have a bunch of questions. People say, well, I heard this, I heard that. Well, we will have a medical professional on tomorrow's program to be able to provide some answers. And again, one of the big questions is, what have we learned since this all started? Because it is not exactly what we thought it was 3 months ago. And I think that we're learning a lot almost every day about the COVID-19 virus. The Lancaster branch of Church World Services assists refugees, immigrants, and asylum seekers who are looking for safety and new lives in the United States. Sheila Mastropietro has spent the last 33 years overseeing the resettlement of literally thousands of refugees in Lancaster County as part of CWS. At one point, there were more resettlements there per capita than anywhere in the country, earning Lancaster the title of Refugee Capital of America. Sheila Mastropietro of Church World Services. Sheila, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Sheila, why is the time right now for retirement?
Well, I am of retirement age. That's part of it. And actually, our office is very strong right now in spite of the last 3.5 years of the current administration chipping away at the refugee program. But I think that our office is strong. I've actually been planning this for a few years. So I just went through with my plans, and I decided this is a good time. My husband's been retired for 2 years now, and I have grandchildren. So I'm just moving ahead.
So when you look back over those 33 years and those thousands of immigrants and refugees who have come to Lancaster County in central Pennsylvania, what do you think? It's tough to encapsulate, I'm sure, 33 years, but what are some of the highlights, some of the things you think about?
Well, you know, when I started, I always think back on this. When I started in 1987 here in Lancaster, there hadn't been a resettlement agency ever here in Lancaster County. And I grew up in Lancaster and always considered it to, it was where I grew up, so I knew it. It was very non-diverse. There wasn't much diversity here. I was happy that we had a community of Puerto Ricans. They, of course, are U.S. citizens, but it was another language and another culture, and I liked that. I liked languages a lot, and I always intended to study languages. But there just wasn't any way. Like, how would you get people from other countries to come here? How and why? And even the refugee program, the modern refugee program, had only begun with the Refugee and Immigration Act of 1980. So it stands to reason that we weren't very diverse, being just not even a large city, of course, and being on the outskirts of larger cities. So I'm just really happy that it worked out as it did, that this was indeed a welcoming community. We've made it much more cosmopolitan, much more diverse, and people are very accepting. But now it makes us more of a global citizen rather than maybe looking more inward as we did 50, 40, 30 years ago.
Okay, so that sounds like that was one of your goals. But what else? I mean, there had to be some, compassion reasons, to be compassionate. You saw that Lancaster County and central Pennsylvania was a good place for those who were seeking asylum or wanted to immigrate, were refugees. What were some of the other reasons that you just saw this as a good fit?
Well, I saw it as a good fit for me because I was always, I've taken all the Briggs-Meyer and so on, and I'm a helper. So I always felt that I had a lot. I had a place to live. I had enough food, and I just bought into the idea that there should be and there is really enough for all. So it made sense that with my love of different cultures and languages, and wanting to be a helper and seeing the all the benefits we have here in America generally, that I wanted to help those who didn't have as much. And when I found the job at CWS, it was just out of graduate school, and I wanted to work with foreign populations and I wanted to help people, but at the time I didn't want to leave Lancaster County, so how was that going to happen? And I was lucky enough to see an ad in the paper in Lancaster for an office, a CWS office in Philadelphia that wanted to start a sub-office here. And when I got to know their mission, the mission of CWS, social justice, helping the displaced, it just fit in totally with my philosophy. And it was a good match, although in the beginning I felt like I wasn't prepared for the work. But it turned out to be a really good match for me.
When you say that the community is welcoming, what do you mean by that?
Well, you know, I have to say that it starts out with all the congregations here, and in particular the Church of the Brethren and the Mennonite, the Anabaptist congregations in Lancaster County. And everyone knows that Lancaster County and some surrounding counties are really strong Mennonite congregations, Mennonite communities. Many of them, what they do is community service. They look outside of themselves. They want to help people in the community, and they also are mission-minded. So many people, many Mennonites in this community and others had worked overseas as missionaries. We're familiar with the different populations overseas and the languages, the cultures, and the need for refuge. So that was a great first step to recognize that in Lancaster County. There were a lot of people here who wanted to help. That was the beginning, and it was a really good start, but now we've expanded so much. We have mosques helping us and synagogues. We have those unchurched people who want to help, who see the humanity in helping those less fortunate than ourselves.
You say that you know, the community was very welcoming, and you just gave some examples of you know, some of the assistance that you've gotten over the years. But unfortunately, what the last few years have shown is that not everyone, and I'm not just talking about Lancaster County, but as the country as a whole, is as welcoming. That immigration, in particular, has become one of the big issues for President Trump. I mean, he was elected by saying he was going to build a wall along the southern border. How are things different now than, say, just a few years ago?
Well, yeah, definitely. You see that very stark difference, and different from when I started, too. Just to go back those 30 years, people didn't even notice what CWS in Lancaster was doing back then. And if they did, it wasn't a big deal. But now, to know, it's really putting yourself out there to support immigrants and refugees. And, yeah, even Lancaster County, America's refugee capital, has the centers here. And I understand that people are fearful and are being, you know, I think sometimes led astray by what they hear in certain media outlets. And we do have people in Lancaster County who don't totally agree with us. But what we try and do is to meet them halfway. We've made efforts to talk to people. I mean, we go to schools and to everybody, you know, outside of churches. We hold forums. There are businesses that try specifically to link, I'm thinking of Bridge, Mustafa Nur's well-known business that tries to link refugee families with people to sit down and have a meal and talk about why they're here. And so, yeah, it's so different. And so everything we do now is politicized, and we, of course, are non-political. So it's been a challenge these last 3.5 years to have our programs funded and to keep on doing what we do. But we've been really successful, I think. The program is still here. That's all I can say. There were many times in the last 3.5 years that we felt that it might not go on, you know, nationally. One of the cornerstones of America, you know, our welcome to immigrants, how the country was really colonized by immigrants, that might have gone away. But we had so many supporters in the U.S. That we're still here.
Yeah, I remember, Sheila, that just a couple years ago where you had to reduce the size of staff. Where does your funding come from, and what does funding look like today?
Well, our funding is primarily from the federal government. So it is the Department of State's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration that funds the U.S. Refugee Program. Of course, the president and Congress both have powers over that department and the number of refugees who come in every year. But it's a federally funded program, so we are, in effect, doing the work of the government. People do try to, of course, and we can, too, try to influence Congress and the president to continue to admit refugees. That's definitely what we should be doing even now. But that's where the majority of our funding comes from. We have a lot of strong supporters, too, so we fundraise. We have a development department, and that's another way that we get funds. We've certainly diversified in the past 3.5 years. All of our work centers around refugees, immigrants, and non-English speakers, but lately we've received funds from local community foundations, the United Way, and we look to other smaller foundations, too, to carry on programs. But definitely the majority is the federal government.
So I'm curious, you say that even in Lancaster County that there are people who may not agree with your mission. Have you heard from some of those people, and what are some of those conversations like?
Over the years we have. It's not a recurring theme. I mean, we hear it in the community, but and we're very well known now, and yet I don't get a lot. I guess I got more calls and emails during the time of the Muslim ban in 2017. I think people were very fearful of Muslims, equating people of the Islam religion with terrorists. So, yeah, back then, we never got any threats per se, but our Facebook page got some comments that we should take care of our own. I think that's where a lot of it ends up. Why don't we take care of our own problems in America instead of helping people from other countries? And we've of course always looked at that, and it's not as if money that goes to refugees would then go to say the homeless or vets. Those programs are very well funded as well, and we do recognize those as serious issues in America. But there is money, and it's Congress who's allocated money to help the refugee resettlement program here.
So over the years, Sheila, where have most of the refugees that have that you've worked with come from, and have there been any changes or trends in the last few years?
Yeah, definitely. When I started, which now seems so long ago, we were getting refugees from the Vietnam War, from Southeast Asia, from Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia. And we were also still receiving refugees from Eastern Europe under communism. So I had Romanian, Bulgarian, and even Czechoslovak. And I remember a Polish gentleman. And that seems, when you think in history, that seems so, so long ago. So it changed over the years. Yeah, a lot of Russians, when at the opening of the former Soviet Union in 1988, and even to this day, we're receiving Christians from the former Soviet republics. So there was that was a long period from 88 until the present. And then we had Cuban refugees, and we started in 2007 to beginning to receive distinct groups of people that the State Department identified. For instance, the Burmese who were in Thailand and Malaysia, they were minority ethnicities who fled Burma, Myanmar. So those populations were recognized as everybody who's in this refugee camp in Malaysia and Thailand, these camps in Thailand, and the U.S. agreed to resettle that group, as well as almost at the same time, the Bhutanese who were in Nepal, in the Nepali camps. So that did change from receiving all you had to do was say that, you know, prove that you were a Russian Christian or Jewish Christian to distinct groups who were located in certain areas. And right now, the Nepali, the Bhutanese, and the Burmese populations are drying up, and we're receiving refugees from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, from Eritrea, and we would be receiving refugees from Somalia, except that most are Muslim, of the Muslim faith, and are still the ban still rests.
Well, Sheila Mastropietro, I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and be happy in retirement. I'm sure the work of Church World Services will go on in Lancaster County. But, Sheila, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for the opportunity. Take care.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we will have a medical professional answering your coronavirus, COVID-19 virus questions. That is coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in.